to the second case of the day, CSX Transportation versus Appalachian Railcar. Mr. Howard.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chuck Howard. I represent the plaintiff appellant, CSX Transportation, Inc. Under Indiana law, CSX is entitled to reimbursement of money it paid to Appalachian Railcar Services as a result of a mistake. CSX made the payment believing that it was responsible for the destruction of 13 rail cars and that it occurred as the result of a derailment. CSX was mistaken as to its responsibility for the damage. The mistake occurred when CSX personnel who were at the scene of the derailment inaccurately reported the location of the derailment as being on CSX's main line.
Now, Mr. Howard, of course, unjust enrichment is an equitable claim. If the two-year statute of limitations bars ARS from recovering its loss from anyone else, why should ARS bear the loss when it's CSX that made the mistake? Did CSX lull ARS into believing that the matter was settled here?
No, CSX didn't lull ARS into believing that the matter was settled. CSX, when it made the payment, believed that the matter was concluded, and it wasn't until afterwards that it discovered that it had mistakenly made the payment. As far as the statute of limitations, it's CSX's position that the statute never began to run. Under Indiana's discovery rule, Appalachian Railcar would have had no reason to believe that anyone else was responsible for the destruction of its rail cars.
Well, I mean, I find that argument very odd. The argument that, that the loss wasn't discovered until you try to get your money back. ARS knew of the loss as soon as it knew the cars were damaged, and the statute has long run since that time, hasn't it?
But ARS would not have had any reason to know that anyone else was responsible. It would have been under no duty to investigate whether any other party would have been responsible. The statute doesn't begin to run until it knows that fact. May I continue?
Please.
Yes. The district court below characterized CSX's payment as a voluntary payment, which under Indiana law may bar recovery. In reaching that conclusion that the voluntary payment doctrine did in fact bar recovery, the court below and Appalachian Railcar has relied on facts which simply are not existent in this record. The first of those facts is that CSX ever disputed the amount to which ARS was ultimately entitled. There never was any dispute. What occurred was that the day that the rail cars derailed, which was April 1st, 2002, CSX personnel were on the scene, and a report was made by the CSX general foreman who was there. He submitted the report to CSX headquarters in Jacksonville, Florida, and on the report it said that the cars had derailed at milepost 331 on CSX's main line. That was the mistake.
Is there any testimony, by the way, or any other evidence, like an affidavit from Brisky, the foreman who entered the coordinates of the derailment into the system?
No, there is no affidavit.
Why?
When we prepared to respond to Appalachian Railcar's 30B6 deposition, our designee investigated the facts of the accident, spoke with Mr. Brisky. There's also documents which the actual report that was sent from the scene to CSX's headquarters, which was signed off by Mr. Brisky.
But you didn't offer an affidavit or a deposition testimony of Brisky.
No, we didn't think we were obligated to do that. The other side was certainly entitled to ask for his deposition. They knew of his existence. We had told him about Mr. Brisky at our own at the deposition of our 30B6 witnesses. There's under the federal rules, there's no obligation that we produce every single person with personal knowledge of the accident. We're only responsible for producing a person who has been prepared himself or herself in this instance to testify as to corporate knowledge and to bind the corporation, which is what occurred here.
But he's the one who entered the coordinates.
He was the one that,
into the system.
He was the one.
Who's more important than he is here, do you think? Who would have been more important than this fellow?
I'm not sure I understand the.
We
produced the person who in Jacksonville who received the report and who set the process spinning, got things rolling. She receives the report. Recognizes based on the mistaken information, of course she didn't know it was mistaken at the time, in the report that the derailment occurred on CSX's main line, and from there it's pretty much automatic. The computer spit out 13 different letters, all addressed to the owner of the rail car, saying, please tell us what these cars are worth, using the Association of American Railroads formula.
Mr. Hart, let me explain my problem. I do not understand why. If ARS relied on CSX's claim that the derailment occurred on CSX's track, I don't understand why ARS should have to bear the cost of CSX's mistake. I cannot, you know, I'm trying to get past it, but I can't.
Well, we're relying on Indiana law that goes back to the 19th century that says that money paid under a unilateral mistake, which is what this was, a fact may be recovered when it would not have otherwise been paid, even when the payor, which in this case was CSX, may have been careless. CSX was certainly careless in this regard. But it doesn't change the fact that Appalachian Railcar was not entitled to these monies paid from CSX. They should have looked... Had CSX not made the mistake, Appalachian Railcars would have had to have looked elsewhere. So there was no dispute. There never has been a dispute among the fact of liability or the amount that CSX, the ARS was entitled to. Another fact that the district court relies on that's just simply not existent in this record is that CSX and Appalachian Rail Cars resolved this dispute, which of course there never was a dispute, through negotiations. The amount was never subject to negotiation. The amount was determined by the Appalachian Rail Cars applying a formula and guidelines of the Association of American Railroads, which both CSX and Appalachian Rail Cars are members of. It did that at the specific request of CSX. All CSX did was confirm those calculations, and once it was confirmed, CSX authorized Appalachian Rail Cars to submit an invoice. CSX cut a check. That's not negotiation. There was no negotiation which resulted in this payment, none whatsoever. The final fact that the district court relies on, which again is not a fact because it's certainly not in this record, is that the amount agreed upon resulted from a compromise on CSX's part because it was uncertain as to the precise location of the derailment. This was not an instance where Appalachian Railcar said, you owe us money, and CSX said, well, we don't think we do, and there was a lot of disputed facts, and well, maybe we do, maybe we don't. Let's come up with a compromise solution. That did not occur here. There was no compromise of anything. The request for the money, the acknowledgement where the derailment occurred was made by CSX. We asked for them to figure out what we owed them. We paid them. There was no compromise. The district court relied on the Supreme Court of Indiana's decision in Time Warner. Time Warner relied on the restatement of restitution, and in the restatement, the writers of the restatement have said that the rule, the voluntary payment doctrine, has no application to the payment of a claim that neither party regards as doubtful. At no time prior to or at the time of the payment did either of these parties ever regard this payment and Appalachian Railcar's entitlement to it as doubtful. And that was because of CSX's mistake. Time Warner also... identify two policy considerations which favor application of the voluntary payment doctrine. One of those policy considerations is that it allows an entity that receives payment for services to rely upon those funds. However, the Time Warner... I'm into my...
Yeah, actually out of time, sorry. But you may conclude that thought, and if you do at that point, I will give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you. The Time Warner Court, however, said that that particular principle only applies when the payee is a governmental unit, which has used the funds on behalf of all of its citizens, and the Time Warner Court also says that it does not apply to a private business. And the other policy consideration was that the doctrine operates as a means to settle disputes to avoid litigation, and I've already argued that there was no dispute, there was no compromise, and there was no negotiation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Mr. Sugarman?
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Given the tenor of the Court's questions earlier, I have just some brief remarks that I'd like to offer and then take some more questions. I would like to highlight two points that illustrate that this Court should affirm the District Court Judge Hamilton's decision below. First, there is no question that CSX payment to Appalachian was a voluntary settlement of its liability for the damage to Appalachian's rail cars. The AAR rules to which both Appalachian and CSX subscribe and have agreed to be bound are designed to promote the timely settlement of liability for destroyed or damaged rail cars. Under these rules, CSX was in no way required to make its payment to Appalachian. Rather, if CSX had not wanted to settle, it should have made use of the arbitration procedures found in the AAR rules, or simply not offered a settlement and waited for Appalachian to take action.
You know, you characterized the exchange of letters and invoices as a settlement contract. And in the briefs, you claim that the payment was made in exchange for a release of possible liability. Where is that release?
The release comes as a function of the AAR rules, Your Honor. The AAR rules, which are in the supplemental appendix to our brief, state that they're for the settlement of claims for damage and destruction on rail lines. And as a function of Rule 107, once payment is made, once that payment is negotiated between the parties, that acts as a full release for liability.
So in other words, it wasn't an express term in any of the paperwork?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor.
So you're simply assuming that the payment released CSX from further liability?
And that was the intent on Appalachian's behalf. With the actions that happened subsequent to the reception of that payment, Appalachian took no further action. They took the check, they deposited it, and they walked away from the scene, feeling that their liability had been completely resolved by the application of the AR rules. And my second point is that CSX's unjust enrichment claims require CSX to demonstrate it relied on a mistake, which resulted in a payment that would not otherwise be due. The record does not support, one, that CSX was ever mistaken as to the location of the derailment of the rail cars, two, that CSX relied on this mistake when it made payment to Appalachian, or three, that payment to Appalachian would not have otherwise been due. Instead, what the undisputed evidence shows is that CSX did not know where the derailment occurred at the time it made payment in 2002, and still does not know where that derailment occurred. Thus, CSX cannot establish that the derailment occurred on Sijico Spur, on track that CSX did not own, nor can it establish that the information contained in the initial derailment report was, in fact, incorrect. Moreover, there is no evidence in the record before this Court, nor is there any evidence below, that CSX actually relied on this alleged mistake when it made payment. And finally, the AAR rules do not support CSX's assertion that it would not have made payment but for its mistaken belief as to where the rail cars derailed. The AAR rules 95, 99, and 107, which are in the record, would still require CSX to take responsibility for the derailment and to pay Appalachian for the damage to its cars, regardless of the location of the derailment. And I'd also like to address your first question from the bench about unjust enrichment being an equitable claim, and indeed is an equitable claim. And here, for it not to apply, I believe that CSX made the concession that it was a voluntary payment. And for it not to apply, the payment would have to be deemed as being not voluntary. Well, there was no fraud, there was no duress, there was no other circumstance that was applied to CSX that would make its payment involuntary. Therefore, the doctrine applies. And there's also, I'd like to emphasize, no evidence in the record that Mr. Brisky was mistaken about the location of the derailment at all. What the evidence does indicate is that CSX didn't know where the derailment occurred in 2002, still doesn't know where the derailment occurred, and all of the paperwork that they submitted is in fact correct. So if there are no further questions from the bench, I would urge the court to affirm the District Court Judge Hamilton's ruling.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sugarman. Mr. Howard?
Yes, just 3 points in responding to Mr. Sugarman. Mr. Sugarman argues that because this is a settlement, or this was a settlement, then the voluntary payment doctrine must apply. Reading from the restatement, which, of course, we know that the Time Warner Court relied on, nor does the voluntary payment rule bar a restitution claim to recover a mistaken payment, notwithstanding that payment was made by way of settlement, where the mistake in question is not one of the uncertainties that the party's transaction was understood to settle. Well, that's just not applicable in this case. We're not talking about any uncertainties. There was no uncertainty at the time that CSX made its payment. It was certain that the derailment had occurred on its track, but it was also mistaken because the derailment did not occur on its track. Another point.
Can we tell whether Mr. Brisky was certain or uncertain where the cars derailed from the report?
From his report, my answer to that would be the report speaks for itself. On the report, he indicates, there's a spot to mark location, and he writes down milepost 331 point something or other, which tells the people in Jacksonville that that's on CSX's main line. Now, Mr. Sugarman also says that CSX did not know where the derailment occurred and that they don't know where we don't know where it occurs now. That's incorrect. The derailment occurred at a derail device, which was installed on this spur, and the derail device is located on the property on track owned by Vectren, or the power company where this all occurred. CSX had a man on the scene who was one of CSX's 30B6 witnesses who knew that the derailment occurred as a result of that derail device. The other person on the scene, however, Mr. Brisky, didn't report that, and that was the mistake. CSX also has corporate knowledge of the fact that the derail device is not on its property. Didn't matter. Mr. Brisky made a mistake, and the mistake resulted in the payment. And finally, Mr. Sugarman says that there's no fraud, no duress, that ARS was responsible for. Two cases, the Time Warner case and the Monroe case, both of those allowed for a voluntary for restitution as a result of a mistake, and in neither case was the conduct or behavior of the payee at issue. CSX would ask that the court reverse the decision below.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Mr. Sugarman, thanks to all counsel. The case is